Go ahead and get started. The title of tonight's presentation is Father Nicola Yanni, His Life and His Legacy. And you've heard me talk about Father Nicola a little bit before. He's an important historical figure, first of all, for our parish. He's the first priest of St. George. But he's also historically important because he was an extraordinary missionary priest, as we'll see, who served this whole central corridor of the United States, and even beyond that sometimes in some ways. So tonight's presentation is the fruit of our ongoing research into the life of Father Nicola, and I have to thank two people for their continued help. First of all, Rocky Steinbrink, who's here with us tonight, Father Nicola's great-great-grandson. And second, Virginia Suleiman, who wanted to be here with us, but she has to work this evening. And Virginia has been, without these two, Rocky for his help and access to the family history and Father Nicola's records, the ones that we do have, and then Virginia for actually being able to translate those records from Arabic into English. Without them, this would not be possible. So I want to thank them before we get started. One of our parishioners who's very interested in Father Nicola has said or summed up his importance in this way. He said, Father Nicola's death was a venerable death. The way that he died in service of his people was heroic in a Christian way. And we can certainly see that from his obituary. And this is from the second page of the Kearney Hub on October 29th, 1918. I'd just like to read this to you all. Reverend Nicola E. Yanni, pastor of the Syrian Orthodox Church in Kearney, passed away at his home here on Tuesday morning, a victim of pneumonia following an attack of the Spanish influenza. During the past week, Reverend Yanni worked faithfully among his parish members here, many of them being stricken with the influenza. Considerable exposure to the disease was inevitable, and although he had complained of not being in the best of health, he continued his work uninterruptedly until the last. Reverend Yanni, since coming to Kearney, won the love of all his people and esteem and admiration of all in the community. He organized the Syrian colony here and established the local church. In recent years, he was assigned a large missionary district extending from Canada to the Gulf and from the Mississippi to the Rockies. Regular visitations within the bounds of this district resulted in him developing a wide acquaintance and thousands of loyal, devoted followers. He did much in the way of community development work while stationed in Kearney, and his untimely death is deplored by the entire municipality. This tells us a lot about what kind of person Father Nicola was, and especially about how he died. A very self-sacrificial death. We'll get into the details of that later, but he died literally while serving his people and from serving his people when an epidemic was going around, a modern-day plague. As close to the plague as we've gotten in the last few centuries. So, truly, his life was venerable and heroic. That his death was venerable and heroic, excuse me. But I think if we look at his life and how he lived, we'll see that his death was just like his life, worthy of admiration and veneration. This is up on the left hand, a picture of Father Nicola's home village. He was born on a Sunday morning, February 5th, 1873, in the small mountain village of Fia Alcura. Today, we would say that's in northern Lebanon. It's about 10 miles from the city, the poor city, Tripoli. But at that time, it would have been considered Syria, in a way. He was born to at least his father, perhaps his mother, were middle-aged by the time of his birth. He was their fifth child, as far as we know, the third son, and his parents went on to have two younger brothers. Where he was born, we'd have a hard time imagining how he grew up. I don't want to go too long tonight because I can really get into a lot of stuff here. But in the minds of the people who lived in this region at that time, there was no such thing really as a national identity. They don't have a nationalism. They're living under the Turks. And they're living kind of in isolated communities of their particular religion. They don't have a sense of ethnicity, really. Today we'll say, oh, well, they're Arabs. They're Lebanese. You know, ethnicity, nationality. But even a little over 100 years ago, this isn't really in their mind. They don't have an identification with a state or a nation. They're second-class citizens living in an oppressive regime. They don't feel a connection across different religions with people who share the same genetic or ethnic background. They have very little. Even amongst the Christians, they're fairly isolated. How they identify or self-identify is primarily family, village, and faith. Where Father Nicola is born, the whole region, even to this day, largely, during his time, probably entirely, not just his village, the whole region is Orthodox. He may have gone his entire life until he got to the United States without meeting someone of another faith. Orthodoxy was the faith of everyone around him. And not only everyone around him, but his last name, the family name, was identified with Orthodoxy. Oftentimes, by someone's name, in this part of the world at this time, you could tell what faith they were coming from. Muslim, other variant Christians, particularly Maronite and Melkite, or Orthodox. The village where you lived also often identified you by your faith. Feel like many small villages like this was entirely an Orthodox village. So it's a pretty amazing way that he grew up. A homogenous way, really. But Orthodoxy informed every facet of social and family life. And even personal identity. Okay. Father Nicola's parents were Elias and Catherine. They were landowners and farmers. This region has some of the oldest olive orchards in the world. And so that's primarily where the agriculture is focused on the cultivation, harvesting of olives, and also other vegetables, fruits, livestock, some subsistence living. Whatever they didn't need, they would sell or trade with others. So he lives working in the fields with his father and brothers, going to church with his family, praying with his family, the Orthodox prayers. And some of you probably heard the Balamond Monastery. The Balamond Monastery is now a university. There's still a monastery there. In Lebanon today, it is probably the most renowned Orthodox university and monastery. Patriarch John spends a lot of time there when he's not in Damascus. The Balamond Monastery is 1.5 miles down the hill from Fia El Qura. Father Nicola grew up going to the monastery on feast days. His education likely happened at the monastery. It's probably there that he learned to read and write. He saw, as they do today, monastics walking through the village. The villagers might have worked on lands around and in the village owned by the monastery. So this monastic Orthodox spirituality is very much a part of his upbringing. You know. And we know members of his family are buried there in the cemetery. So this gives us a little bit of an idea of how Father Nicola grew up. There's a boat. Before we get to the boat, another small village at the base of Balamon Monastery, even closer, is the village of Kilhot. And Father Nicola had family there, some extended family, and that's where a young woman named Martha Albaic grew up. We don't know. It's so close that I imagine they must have known each other or known of each other. But Martha was Nicola's uncle's daughter. So some kind of cousin, some relation of cousin. And at some point, probably during his 19th year, the two families got together. And at that time, it would have been an arranged marriage. The engagement ceremony would have happened at the Albaic home in Kilhot. And then, however long later it was, probably just a matter of months, the wedding took place at the village church, St. Simon Church. St. Simon, the stylite, the patron saint of the village of Phia. And we know that that took place, the marriage of Nicola and Martha, in Phia on November 8, 1892, served by the priest from the village of Phia and two priests from the village of Kilhot. An Arab wedding, still today, but even back then more so, a very, very, very festive thing. And when his brother George got married here in Kearney, it was the second marriage that Father Nicola did after he was ordained, it got into a little legal trouble because the party was so loud and crazy. They ended up being acquitted and they were fine because some young men came and got some beers. And anyway, it was a pretty wild time. Very festive. Festivities leading up to and then after the wedding. But Nicola and Martha's wedding was tinged with sadness because very quickly after their wedding, they left for the New World. They left their home and the family who still remained in Phia. Many of them would emigrate, or a few of them had already emigrated to the United States. But his father, his other extended family, Nicola and Martha left in late 1892 to never return. They came but via steamship. This is really an interesting time in the world. Steamship technology has just developed so that new trade paths are open, and along with that, travel. So, a couple generations before this, the mass immigrations from the old world to the new world, and especially this part of the old world, were not possible. Quickly, with steamships becoming very common, very efficient, they actually sent agents from the port cities of Tripoli, Beirut, through the villages. You would have their reports of like a travel agent almost, on a donkey, if you can imagine, climbing up these dusty trails and roads, going through the villages, again and again, making tours, and trying to sign people up to get them to buy a ticket to go to the New World and have a new life there. And Nicola and Martha decided to do that very thing. And here's a nice print of the typical accommodations in the steerage that they would have taken. It could be a very nice trip. You might have met some friends, family. There's reports. People would get together and sing songs, very excited about going to the new world and this prospect of a new life. But it could also be very miserable. The accommodations might be very poor if it was kind of a corrupt steamship line. And of course, many, many people got seasick. So it was usually a pretty miserable passage. Sometimes almost a festive passage, depending. We don't know about their particular passage. We do know that it took them 26 days to get from probably Tripoli that would have ported probably in France and then come to New York City, the precursor to Ellis Island. There they got on a train and came straight to Omaha. They didn't stop. They came straight to Omaha. And that whole trip from Fia to Omaha lasted 26 days. Quite a trip. What brought them to Omaha? Well, in the mid-1800s, American Protestant missionaries began to go to the Middle East. The Turks would not allow them to proselytize or preach to the Muslims, so they turned to the Christians. They turned to us. And they did good things. They established schools, like much that goes on in American Protestant missionary endeavors. There are also some problematic things. But it did introduce them to America, and a few people took that opportunity to go to that land of promise that the American missionaries talked about. And one man named Michael Hayek came from the village of Fia. There was a Presbyterian missionary group active out of Omaha, and likely it was that connection that brought Michael Hayek to Omaha. And that subsequently brought many other people from Fia and what we know of today as Lebanon. Okay. When Nicola arrived in Omaha, he worked like so many Syrian immigrants did. The vast majority of them worked as peddlers. They liked to work outside. They shunned factory work and being inside in a factory or in a mine underground, like many other European immigrants did. They came, they liked to be out of doors. They were used to this. They liked to travel. They could, in a way, be almost self-employed from the very beginning. They would find a benefactor, a peddler who had come, been successful. They would work for him. That peddler would supply the wares. And then someone, their stores right off the boat, they would go wandering the streets and sell wares. And very quickly they would make money, they would do fairly well. Nicola, like so many other Syrian immigrants who took up the peddling trade, some of them would travel across the country, at least across the state. We know that Nicola was based out of Omaha with other families and young men from Syria and the Middle East, traveling all through Nebraska and the Midwest. And this is how they made their living. We see here a picture of Nicola right after these years with his wife Martha. While they're in Omaha, they have their first two children, Elias, little boy right here, and Anna, their daughter. And then, after they moved from Omaha, Nicola was reunited with one of his younger brothers, George, who came down from Canada to live with them. After a few years in Omaha peddling, not long after Anna's birth, so a little while before that last picture, Nicola decided he must have come across some business connections, heard about land that he could rent, saw possibilities in the area. Michael Hayek had come to Kearney in the late 1880s. It was a boom town. It was very profitable in the late 1880s, early 1890s, before an economic crash hit the area. But Nicola decided he wanted to return to his family's vocation of farming. So he found this land, and this is actually Rocky and Brock and I went out and by God's grace found this. This is actually the site where Nicola and his family would have moved in 1895, 7 miles north of Gibbon. They rented this land. They had some livestock. They had chickens. They sold eggs. They raised pigs. Sold pigs. We just found this. I just found this out 2 hours ago. And they did some peddling as well. His brother George continued to have a peddling route between, I think, Alliance and Omaha. And so they lived out here from 1895 to 1904. And this was here where Nicola was reunited with George. They became known and set up business as the Annie Brothers. They lived, you notice there's nothing here now. We looked, they lived in a sod house, a two-room soddy. There's nothing there anymore that we could find. Lived very simply. Rocky, what was your impression of being out there?
Very harsh.
Very harsh.
That would be not the spot that I would pick to start.
Not the spot that you would pick. But, you know, all the spots out there pretty much look exactly like that. So before the days of irrigation and pivots. While they were there, they had two more sons, John Yanny and Moses Yanny. To the site of the homestead from around 1895 to 1904. Nicola and Martha were some of the earliest Syrian immigrants to the area, but by late 1899, there were about 40 men, women, children of a Syrian Orthodox background. Other family members like John Shada and his family, Mo Shada, others, they would write back and say primarily how wonderful it was to be in a place where you were free to worship as you wanted. They really experienced a lot of oppression from the Muslim Turkish authorities. And we can read in some early histories of St. George from some people who are of this first generation, that is what motivated them to come. Not economic promise. That was certainly a part of what they found when they arrived, if they worked hard. But their motivation in coming was religious freedom. Their faith was central to them. They would get together and celebrate feast days. They would take donations. Father Nicola, before he's ordained, is writing down who is giving what he's giving. Someone's donating meat, someone's donating money, and they're having like the feast of the patron saint of their village on September 1st, the Orthodox New Year, St. Simon. Other feasts, they're getting together, but they don't have a church yet. The first time they come in contact with an Orthodox priest is St. Raphael of Brooklyn before he's ordained a bishop. Remember, he's ordained in 1904. He comes in 1895 to the United States. That's a picture of him, what he looked like when he came from Russia. When he's coming, right when he arrives in America, is right about the time that Nicola and his family moved to Buckeye Valley, north of Gibbon. St. Raphael begins hearing about scattered Orthodox communities and begins making missionary journeys back and forth across the United States. And it's on his third missionary journey in the fall of 1899 that he comes to Kearney. He's heard about Kearney and the people here. He's come to visit them. He shows up at midnight from Omaha and he's sick. The whole parish, as you've heard me say, is still waiting there for him. Everyone's waiting there. The Yannies have come in, or at least Nicola has come in from out of town. He's the one who lives furthest out. The rest of the Syrian community is there. He's too sick to serve liturgy, but he prays with them. He stays up till like 4 in the morning talking with them. The next day, in the early afternoon, he gets in a wagon with a young man and drives, arriving at a homestead in the middle of the night. And we are almost entirely sure that this is Nicola and Martha's homestead. Nicola, as far as we've been able to find, is the only one who lived that far outside of Kearney. Anyone else who lived farther away, it would have been impossible to get there in that amount of time. When he arrives at the Annie homestead, the next morning, he serves Orthros, and he does the lesser blessing of waters. So he's going out, he's blessing the livestock, blessing their house, the stable, the corrals, the ground, the things they're growing. They come back in, and surely the whole Yanny Kennedy family comes back into Kearney with St. Raphael after that day spent with him. And that weekend, St. Raphael baptizes six children, four of whom are the Annie children: Elias, Anna, John, and Moses. Okay? And that's, as we said, St. Raphael. And that is not the image, because we don't have it, but that's an image of a typical sod house, similar to the two-room soddy that the Annie family would have lived in for almost a decade. And it was 22 miles outside of Kearney. Okay? Nicola and George were doing fairly well. I mean, they weren't, not by our standards, but they were doing well enough to help. He was sent, and we have several of the letters, sent messages from home: can you help us? You know, it was a bad year here in Fiat. Can you send us some support? Can you send us some money? Can you send us some money for passage to America? We know in one particular case, Nicola and his brother George did this. And they were, having been reunited in the year 1900, they were reunited with their older brother, 20 years older than Nicola, their brother Simon, who they brought from Brazil. He was visiting some family in Brazil. Okay, Nicola continued to work on the farm and probably do some side peddling. Of course, George is working on his peddling route. And it appears that Simon was also out there living with them. And they may have had another soddy. They might have built a second soddy to live in. Here we have a photo from around that time. It's the last photo that we have of the whole Yaney family. We see Nicola, the nice mustache there, next to Martha, their four children: Elias, Moses, the youngest son, John, and daughter Anna. And I believe likely that previous picture we saw of the family, you could tell Martha was pregnant with John, and likely, because of the timing and the age of Moses, she's likely pregnant with their fifth child. This is the last photo that we have of the whole family, because very tragically, on Tuesday morning, February 11th, in 1902, at 10 a.m., Father Nicola recorded, Martha died during or immediately after childbirth. And the little girl, who was named Noor, something like that in Arabic, but seems to have been called Catherine, as the family members, died 9 days later, also in the morning. And they were buried in the Burgess family cemetery. An Irish family who lived 3 or 4 miles north of their homestead allowed them to bury their departed ones there. And there's no priest, remember? So Nicola and his loved ones and family come from Kearney, bury Martha. And maybe he offers some words on that hill. A very tragic time. Nicola, knowing that likely, because she died that quickly, premature daughter, would have given her a layman's baptism. So, tragic, tragic time in the family. During this time, that's 1902, by 1903... more are coming from Fia and from other places in the Middle East. Dir Mimas, around the monastery of St. Sabas, other places. So the Kearney Syrian community is beginning to grow. Those who have been peddlers for a while are becoming, some of them, not all of them, are becoming a little more established, opening small grocery stores, small dry goods stores. And they've been getting together on the feast days. They've been keeping their faith. But St. Raphael planted in them that spark, that desire for a church, a desire to worship in their own language according to their own customs with their own faith. And so they decided, we're at a point we can found a church. They ask for St. Raphael's blessing. He gives them the blessing and says, your church community will be under the patronage of St. George on on the evening of Pascha in 1903. They get together at John Shada's home. John Shada, Michael Haig, and Nicola being kind of the three leaders of the Carney and Syrian community. They get together there. They read the letter from St. Raphael. They'd asked him, please send us a priest. We're ready. We'll support a priest. We're ready. St. Raphael said, I'm sorry. I don't have anyone to send you. He had been looking for people to recommend for ordination. He had been trying to bring over some priests, and he had brought a few over from Syria, but he had no one to send them. So he said, I personally believe it likely he must have had Nicola in mind. They had a long trip on that wagon to talk. He said, choose someone worthy of the priesthood from amongst yourselves. And the people there chose Nicola. And it's recorded that he was picked because he was well-liked and respected by everyone, and that he was very knowledgeable in his orthodoxy. And remember what that means to us. Remember, a theologian isn't someone who knows about the textbooks. A theologian is someone who prays. So he's knowledgeable here, but he's knowledgeable here. And this is a year and a half after his wife and daughter have died. And it was a hard time for him. But they must have seen something in him that inspired them and made them think, this man is worthy to be a priest in his suffering, his faithfulness to God. He is worthy. He is well versed in his orthodoxy, well tested. He's chosen. And I think especially from outside of the Orthodox tradition, we don't realize what this choice means. He is a single father. He's 30 years old. He is a widower of three boys, young boys. And he knows that if he accepts ordination, he cannot remarry. Death during childbirth was pretty common in the ancient world and even back then. And there are many people who remarried and had kind of second families. It's a possibility that Father Nicola's own father did that. And we don't know that for sure. It's a possibility. Because some of his siblings are so much older than him, and then there's a group that's around his age and younger. It was common in accepting ordination. Father Nicola knows he will never remarry. He's committing his life to God. And his sons will not have the love and comfort of a mother or stepmother figure. But he makes this sacrifice. He chooses this. This is the Cotton Mill Schoolhouse, I think, without the bell tower. That's added later. Having found a priest, someone they could send to be trained and ordained, they also found a building, an unused schoolhouse out near Cotton Mill Park, a few miles northwest of town. They pooled their money. They bought the house. If we ever write more and get the biography written, we'll go into more detail. But St. Raphael sent an archimandrite, a monastic priest from the East Coast, Father Miletius Karum, who went out there, served the first service there, blessed it, and then spent a day with Nicola. And what would be a nice word? Interviewed him. Tested him. I've been through it. Canonical, to see if there were any canonical impediments to ordination. To make sure that he had lived purely, chastely, uprightly, that there was nothing in the way for him to be ordained a priest. After that, they served another liturgy. Father Miletius went home and reported to St. Raphael, this man is ordainable. They continued to meet out here on Sundays, and then they eventually gathered the funds, if you can believe it, to move that building into town near where Pizza Hut is on 2nd Avenue with horses. Can you imagine a horse and mule team moving a building? This is a picture of immediately after St. Raphael's consecration on February 29, 1904. All the dates I'm giving you are the old calendar dates following the Orthodox calendar, 14 days off of the modern civil calendar that we use. So in what we would call early March, according to ours, mid-February, the Russian Orthodox Synod votes to consecrate St. Raphael a bishop. Up to this time, he's a priest. He's a monastic priest. They consecrate him. They plan on consecrating him a bishop, which they do in New York City at St. Nicholas Syrian Orthodox Church in Brooklyn. And this is the event that Nicola's ordination, the priesthood, is planned around. Okay? So, because it takes a bishop to ordain a priest, right? So, with the support of the Kearney community, Mike Haig, and especially John Shada, his wedding sponsor, the best man at his wedding, and the godfather to Nicola's children, Nicola's here somewhere. Maybe not in the picture. I've looked, but he's sent to New York to study. To train. He's there for 6 weeks, maybe a couple months. St. Raphael is the first Orthodox bishop to be consecrated, not in the United States, not in North America, in the Western Hemisphere. And a few weeks later, the first man to be ordained to the Holy Priesthood by the first bishop made in the Western world is Nicola Janney. On March 3rd, he is made a reader. On March 6th, he is made a subdeacon. On March 14th, old calendar again, on the fifth Sunday of Lent, he is made a deacon. Father Nicola records this in his family Bible, that he was made a deacon on the fifth Sunday of Lent. And then on March 21st, Palm Sunday, during the Holy Liturgy, St. Raphael lays his hand on Nicola's head and ordains him priest. Likely the vestments that Father Nicola is wearing. This photo we found out is actually around 1909, because that's when the gospel book was given to Father Nicola by the parish. But likely these vestments and the cross were given as a gift from Tsar Nicholas II by St. Raphael to Father Nicola. This was common. The Tsar of Russia, the Orthodox Emperor, was like a sponsor for these missionary activities. So these would have been a gift from the Tsar, given to him at his ordination in 1904 by St. Raphael. He was also given a very, very, very fine, large gold pocket watch. We don't know from who. Inscribed with March 21st, 1904, the date of his ordination, the priesthood.
It's in the family.
And it's a very fine watch. There's something attached to it which is even greater. But, I wonder if it's John Shada or the Kearney community. It could have been St. Raphael. We don't know. But it's the pocket watch that Father Nicola kept in his watch to catch all those trains that he's going to be living on and traveling on. This is given to him as an ordination present. Several weeks after his ordination, a telegram comes into the Kearney community. They're waiting, they're waiting for the word. And after he's ordained, a telegram comes to Kearney that says he's been ordained and he'll be back in a few weeks. When he comes back, likely then, maybe earlier, but perhaps with him, he brings many church vessels, sacred things, icons, the chalice, the discos. There were missionary kits given. We have some of those things up in the church still. Again, sponsored by Tsar Nicholas. They were given. There were crates with icons and vestments and lamps and things that were given to, kind of jumpstart a church. It was like Orthodox missions, And so either this came before or Father Nicola brought it back with him from New York to adorn their brand new church. Okay. His obituary said that recently he had been given a missionary territory. That is a mistake. From the word go, he is given a missionary territory. It's reported as vast. It was from the Rockies to the Mississippi, from the Canadian border to the Gulf of Mexico. And that's certainly true. He actually did go to Pennsylvania. He did some things in lower Michigan. He did some things in Chicago once or twice. And went to Indiana a few times. He went down even to Alabama. But this is really, from the records we can see, his very active territory. Very active territory. There were other occasional visiting priests to the isolated Syrian Orthodox scattered throughout the Great Plains. But it's in this territory that Father Nicola really oversees. And he's not just an itinerant priest. He's not just a traveling minister in this area to these people. But he's really the pastor and the leader, the spiritual leader of the scattered communities throughout this area. Huge. This is his parish. Some were large communities in cities. Large communities like Wichita, like Kearney. Kearney's the biggest. Till even after his death. Upper Minnesota, Wisconsin, La Crosse. North Dakota. There's a lot of Syrian Orthodox in North Dakota. Okay, and he's visiting cities. He's visiting rural areas where there's large communities, homesteaders who live near each other. And he's also visiting individual families who live alone out in the middle of nowhere. Roanoke, Kansas. Doesn't exist anymore. So he's traveling and doing all this. He's holding liturgy and baptisms and weddings. Sometimes in a church, and that would be in an Episcopal church, but most often in the people's homes. They're having liturgy in the living room. Okay. Father Nicola's missionary territory. Arkansas, Colorado, Illinois, Iowa, Kansas, Kentucky, Upper Peninsula, Michigan, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Tennessee, and Wisconsin. And as I said, he made visits also to Alabama, Indiana, Lower Michigan, and Pennsylvania. This is a neat story. We don't have a lot of personal stories from Father Nicola. Most of what we know has been found through archives and newspapers. But this is a neat story. Anyone recognize this place? It's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Actually, it's a replica of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre at the St. Louis World's Fair in 1904. They built a full-scale model of the Holy Sepulchre, a really neat fair, the largest World's Fair to date. And they brought many people over from the Middle East, and they had church services. It's a full-scale replica of the Holy Sepulchre Church in the middle of St. Louis. It's not there anymore. It fell apart and was taken down after the World's Fair. Father Nicola, just a few months after his ordination, is invited to come and do an Orthodox liturgy. Here's the church we can see right here. To come and do an Orthodox liturgy for the first time in this church. And there are 1,000 people there. Dignitaries visiting the World's Fair from all over the world, the officials from the World's Fair who are putting this on, curious onlookers. I mean, we're going to see what... I mean, this is an exotic... 10 acres of the World's Fair is dedicated to Jerusalem. They recreated the Dome of the Rock and some other things. Full scale. And they're going to do a liturgy. And people... 1,000 people show up. But they changed the rules. Father Nicola shows up with 4 deacons. It must have been 4 chanters. To get ready Sunday morning for the liturgy. And they will not let him in. Because he has signed his ticket with pencil. And the week before they had changed the rule and said, it must be signed with pen. Your pass to get in must be signed with pen. They refused to let him in. And they're running back and forth between the church to say, hey, you know, let us in. You know, what's going on? They're telling the people, oh, he's stuck. He can't get in. So a visiting Monsignor with a couple other Roman Catholic clergy decide, well, we can't have the liturgy. We will stand up and we will do the Mass. So they steal the show and they do the Roman Catholic Mass. In the meantime, the president, the head of the St. Louis Fair, calls in early on Sunday morning and says, let him through the gate. Let him in. So he gets there. Mass is over. These people, it's now an hour and a half after liturgy is supposed to start. It's over. Father Nicola comes in and tells the people, turn your chairs around. In the Orthodox Church, we do not face the setting sun like they do in the West. We face the rising sun, where Christ will come again from east to west like lightning. Turn your chairs around. And he made them deconstruct and take apart the altar that they had served on the western side of the church. They reassembled it on the eastern side of the church. And he did liturgy. I think that says something about the personality and the faithfulness of Father Nicola and his patience. And he did a baptism there a few days later. Okay, just a personal story about his life. Another interesting, something that's kind of interesting and unique to a large degree. For much of his priesthood, when Father Nicola is traveling around, we see a blown up picture here. This is Sam Shada, a friend and family member, Nick Shada's dad. You can't see the details in the picture, but we have newspaper reports about Father Nicola's appearance. He was very traditional. You see him in his Kamalovkin, his hat. He's wearing his cassock. And he doesn't, as is traditional in many parts of the world still, from his ordination on, he does not cut his hair. He has a jaduli. He has a long hair, almost like a Nazirite. And he does not trim his beard. This is a picture, actually, of one of his successors, his immediate successor, Father Elias Hamati. And this is more like a Syrian Orthodox priest coming to America would have looked or encouraged to look like an Episcopal clergyman. He's got like a nice kind of long coat there. It goes down. But wearing the collar, very trimmed, cut hair. Because, you know, these are immigrants. They want to fit in. They want to assimilate. They don't want to appear strange. They want to appear relevant. What are people used to? What's a high church clergyman? Well, like probably a Lutheran clergyman or a Roman Catholic clergyman or an Episcopal clergyman. And this is how St. Raphael chooses to look not long after his arrival in the United States. Father Nicola is isolated, but I think there's also that monastic spirituality, the influence of the Balaman and the monks that he saw in his village priest. And he's faithful to what he learned. And for him, an Orthodox priest never cuts their beard or their hair. In the last years of his life, he did adopt the prevailing appearance. And he did trim his beard and cut his hair. Most likely either in 1914 after a visit from St. Raphael or 1916. I actually believe this in 1916 because we can see a difference between two photos that we have that are only a month apart when Metropolitan Germanus Shahadi visits. And he either does this, trimming his beard and making his appearance fit in more with American culture, either in obedience to his bishops or at least at their suggestion. But this vow, even this outward thing of not cutting your hair, living in repentance and living with no vanity, he saved his jaduli. And the chain, we found this, the chain that he had on his watch that was later added is this beautiful braid. And Rocky said, when we visited at the Yanni family reunion, Father, that's hair. And there's a nice little gold crossing. It's this beautiful braided hair, which they did back in that time. They would take hair and they would braid it. So he has this several stranded, very intricately braided chain that is attached to his gold watch. It is his vow, his sign, his commitment to his priesthood. So he kept it. It was a precious thing to him. So we see Father Nicola and Father Elias. This is a photo of Father Nicola with his sons, Elias, Moses, and John, around 1908. Father Nicola would be gone for several months at a time, usually twice a year. And when they were younger, his children stayed with his brother, George. Remember, they've grown up with George. George has been around since probably around 1897. Elias would be four. You know, George is like a second father to them. And George married Rebecca Shada. They lived in Riverdale. And so when Father Nicola is gone during the younger years of his children's lives, the boys and Anna would go and stay with George and Rebecca. And they would take care of them. While he was on a missionary journey in Colorado in early June of 1907, Nicola receives an urgent message to return home. His daughter Anna was very sick. She apparently had chronic heart problems. He returned. We do know she's buried near his tomb in the cemetery. We know he made it back in time to see her. But in his sacramental records, it says that she had received communion the last time at Pascha. So before he'd gone on the journey, so likely she was unconscious. Likely she was unconscious. And she died on a Friday and was buried the next day. And Father Nicola, she was 12, Anna. And Father Nicola served and preached her funeral. There was no one else to do that, you know. That's uncommon. You know, when Father Philip, when Lily died, you know, the bishop came up and the priest came. Father Philip sat with the family. He didn't have to serve. You know, we're not going to make someone serve the funeral of their own wife. And even greater, to serve the funeral of your own child. So at this point, all the girls, Martha, Catherine, and Anna, all the women of the family have died. And it's only Father Nicola and his three boys left. Yet even in the face of all this tragedy, he continues. After this time, I mean, I would be fearful of leaving home again. You know, his daughter died, almost died, while he was gone. And yet, he continues to go out on these months-long missionary journeys, because that's his commission. That's his responsibility. Who else is going to take care of the people? Just like St. Raphael took care of him in 1899 and baptized his children. And like that lack of a priest that he felt in his heart at his worst hour when his wife and infant daughter died, he knew what that was like. And I think that formed his priesthood, his vision of the priesthood. That he needed to go and minister these people, to give them a priest. Because he knew what it was like to both have a priest come to visit him, but also what it was like to not have a priest in the darkest hours. So, this is St. Raphael as he appeared near the end of his life, in the last years. And he returns to Kearney 15 years later. 15 years, Kearney and parishes and communities, this whole region hadn't seen their bishop. Father Nicola had been the one who was the pastor. St. Raphael gave that commission over to Father Nicola. And St. Raphael continued being a missionary in other places, but he really gave this to Father Nicola. And other priests, but primarily Father Nicola in this region. Okay. He returns. It's been since 1904. It's been 10 years, over 10 years since Nicola has seen Bishop Raphael, most likely. We have no evidence that he'd ever returned to New York. He's too busy. How can he get there? There's a parish-wide meeting. There must have been some tension. Father Nicola had been, the parish council had agreed to pay him $45 a month. And St. Raphael comes, has a parish-wide meeting and says, we're all going to do this, right? We're going to pay Father Nicola $45 a month. Even in 1914, that's still not, it's more than $45, but it's not that much more. It's not a lot of money. So I figured it out. It's written down somewhere. A couple hundred dollars. And they a part of that salary was he had to be in Kearney at least, not at least, 8 months out of the year. So he's not here 8 months out of the year. Almost, but he's the demands on his time, travels. So 8 months out of the year, he needs to be in Kearney. 2 months in the winter, 2 months in the summer is when he travels. And he kind of sticks to this. And at this point, his missionary territory is shrinking a little bit to what we saw, because there are some other parish communities. There's more priests coming to visit them. So on some of the edges of his territory, some of the outlying areas, there's someone else there to help. He's still going. But they also founded an Arabic school for the children to teach them Arabic and to teach them Orthodoxy. That met at the church. And for those who could afford it, St. Raphael said, Father Nicola is teaching your children every day after school when he's in town. So you must give him 50 cents per month per student if you can afford it. So Father Nicola taught the children. And then there were plans. There's about 180 people now to 200. That's the size of the parish. Church is too small. So there's a plan. We need to build a new church. And the plan is, so the original schoolhouse has been refurbished. It's right there. It's right next door. It's on our side yard. The plan is, have the church there, build this church. And he had a fairly good idea of the size, what they wanted, this church here. And then reconvert that building back into a full-time schoolhouse for the children. So this vision of educating the kids in their culture and in their faith, keeping that building, having a new church. Okay? So, Father Nicola said, we're planning on building it. We're starting next year. Okay? All that gets changed. St. Raphael dies. He returns from his, we're one of the last parishes he visits. He visits a few more. He returns to New York City. And he gets sick. Immediately after his return, he's exhausted. He struggled with, he had suffered from some heart ailments. And continues to decline very rapidly. And he dies in late February of 1915. That's a photo of a liturgy, after a liturgy before his funeral. He lies in state for about a week. Father Nicola gets the telegram. He's shocked. Says that he had, I forget exactly how the paper says it, deep feelings, deep connection with the bishop who ordained him, with St. Raphael. But he decides, he doesn't think he's able to go, but he does. He's able to go. He arrives after this picture is taken. He's there for St. Raphael's funeral, which he returns a month later. Father Nicola visits some family out on the east in Pennsylvania. He goes to New York as well. Visits his sister in Manesson, Pennsylvania. Not Manesson. Johnstown, Pennsylvania. And he's gone for a month. He comes back, and there's a beautiful newspaper article. He describes to the reporter that it is the most magnificent sight he's ever seen. St. Raphael's funeral. Most magnificent sight. Thousands of people. 300 New York police officers, a riding, a mounted regiment. They walk through the streets of Brooklyn. Amazing. You can read about it elsewhere. But he comes back inspired and impressed in this tragedy. Sadly, there's a lot of chaos that comes in after St. Raphael's death. He kind of held the whole archdiocese, this with the Syrian Orthodox mission together. There's 29 communities now, parish communities, and other communities that haven't developed into churches yet. But there's a real question after St. Raphael dies. St. Raphael is operating sort of as a bishop under the Russian Orthodox Church, but it's not exactly clear. Even St. Raphael himself says things like that he is still operating under the authority and blessing of the Church of Antioch as well. So these Syrian communities, even at St. Raphael's funeral, are, I don't want to say panicking, but wondering. They're distressed. St. Raphael, by the power of his personality, by his saintly character and his humility and sacrificial spirit and his loving kindness, held everything together. Without him, there's a real vacuum of power or authority, or we've lost our shepherd. And so the question arises, do we go with Russia? Are we under these Russians, or are we under really Antioch? We are actually, we're Syrians, we're under the Patriarchate of Antioch. It's a real question. During this time, there was a bishop, Metropolitan Germanos Shahadi, who came over to raise funds while St. Raphael was still alive and tour North America. World War I started. He couldn't go home, or decided he didn't want to go home. So he begins making his rounds to the different parishes, and he's very pro-Antioch. He's a very impressive character. The newspapers here and throughout the cities he visited, the American press is just impressed with this guy. And I think the people are too. He's famous even, has one of the most beautiful voices. He's still famous for it, even today. He visits here in October of 1916. At this point, still saying he's on tour to raise funds. But 1 month later, we see here's Elias, here's Father Nicola. You can tell he's trimmed up a little bit this time. Here's Metropolitan Germanos. This is the parish in Ironwood, Michigan, where Mary Abraham, a beautiful young woman, is from. She's a relative of the Annie family, and it's time for Elias, Father Nicola's oldest son, who's would be 23 now, I believe, turning 23. It's time for Elias, EK, to get married. Yanny Park is in their memory and their honor. Elias, EK, and Mary Yanny. By the efforts of the Yanny family and the community. This is their wedding, and Metropolitan Germanos shows up. Because a priest's child can actually have the special blessing of having the bishop marry them. It's a special thing. So Metropolitan Germanos comes, and certainly, again, endears himself to this community. This is a community that Father Nicola had served. These are also, the core are people who have immigrated from Fia, so friends and relatives. Elias and Mary had never met before the wedding. There's a story that she had a friend who was very upset that EK was getting was coming, and they were going to scare him. And so he got some friends, and they went to the train station. And EK had never been to Ironwood before. He probably heard of these people. He never met them. Father Nicola is visiting here twice a year. He knows these people. And some of them are, again, family. Not knowing Ironwood very well, he mercifully steps off the wrong side of the train onto the other platform and never meets the thugs that have come to scare him, send him back to Kearney. So Mary and EK are married. They're both probably a little startled and a little shocked and maybe a little dismayed, but they quickly grow in their love, have 9 children, become pillars of the community and of our church community. Immediately after the wedding, there's no rest for the good. There's no rest for the wicked either, but there's no rest for the good and the righteous. After the wedding, immediately, Father Nicola is on the road again. missionary journeys. And a few days later, E.K., Elias, and Mary return to the small house just south, one block south of the church, where Father Nicola lived with the boys, and now Mary lives with them, all together in that small home. November 12th, 1916. Just another snippet into the kind of priest that Father Nicolaiani was. And I know a lot of priests. I know a lot of priests because the priests in this diocese are the best. Who would do the same thing? But still, it says a lot. It says a lot. Yaney called to funeral makes 1,000-mile trip to officiate at services from the Kearney Daily Hub, October 23rd, 1915. Reverend Yaney returned from a 1,000-mile trip to Oklahoma near northern Texas to attend the Imam Jacobs' funeral, which was held from the Syrian church Friday morning. Jacobs was killed being trampled to death by horses in Colorado while plowing beets. He's one of the people in the Walsenburg or Trinidad area in Colorado, or maybe Abel, Colorado. I haven't tracked down, but southwestern Colorado, southeastern Colorado, where Father Nicola is visiting often. He's killed, this young man, and they ship the body here to Kearney to be buried from the church. And Reverend Yaney was called from his regular visitation trip. He returned at the earliest possible moment, and after a brief stay will return to Oklahoma. How they got a hold of him, telegraph, who knows. They got a hold of him, and Father Nicola doesn't say... Have the Episcopal priest come in. Just pray over him. Give him the, you know, do a reader's service burial. Father Nicola immediately comes back, buries him, and then he says, I need some. He goes back to southern Oklahoma, where there's also a large scattered communities, a large population of Syrian Orthodox. Okay, just another insight into this man's priesthood. The extent of Father Nicola's priestly and missionary service. So these are the recorded sacraments. Okay, baptisms, 910. And remember, there's a slew of 38 in a row that he does in a small town in Brinkman. He stays there for like 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks. Brinkman, Oklahoma. But these baptisms are done 1, 2, 3 at a time, 4 at a time. In this city, that state. So 910 is a big number for me to think about. I will not baptize nearly that many people in my lifetime if God gives me many years, which I need for repentance. So pray that I live to be 150 and repent of my sins. But maybe not that long. He's doing this 1, 2, 3, 4 at a time. All over. 910. That gives us some idea. Chrismations. Obviously he's doing baptisms and chrismations together. Chrismations of those who've been baptized in another Christian tradition. 10. A couple were children. Some were older children, 15. Some were adults. So people embracing Orthodoxy later. So there's even converts back then. Marriages, 107. Again, that's a lot. And funerals, 36. We know 99 of the names of the places that he went to, but there's a few we cannot make it out. Sometimes it doesn't exist anymore. It may have been a township. It may have been 3 or 4 homes that had a name, you know, in an area. So Father Nicola visited over 100 different communities.
In how many years?
14. 14 years. 14 and a half years. But no, remember, these are... He's got some of these, like Dothan, Alabama. We know that he only went to... Well, as far as we know, he went once. Hotsdale, Pennsylvania, twice. But most of these are on his circuit. So he's not visiting 100 different places, you know, like he went to 100 different places. He's going to 100 different communities repeatedly. Okay? And sometimes they change because people move. Okay? But I say this, where we know he went is from this. That's all we know from where he went. But we know, I know he's in Wichita times when he's not doing baptisms. So we know his journeys from his sacramental records. But what about the times when he went to a place, they didn't have new babies there that year? There were still Orthodox Christians there. He went there and he did the liturgy and he heard confessions. So his travels that we know of are just the sacraments he performed, not where he went and did liturgy. That's even more. Okay? Okay, communities he visited, major communities of Syrian Orthodox immigrants of Orthodox faith. The Syrian Orthodox immigrants of Orthodox faith. That's a little redundant, isn't it? Iron Mountain, Michigan. Omaha, Nebraska. St. Paul, Minnesota. Williston, North Dakota, up in the northwest corner of North Dakota. A large population of Orthodox there. Rugby, North Dakota. McCluskey and Denhoff, North Dakota. I've been to North Dakota, but not as far as these places. And it's a long way away, but with a car, it's a long way away. Driving well over the speed limit, it's a long way away. Walsenburg and Trinidad, Colorado. And Oklahoma City. These are the major ones, but there are many smaller places that he goes. Tryon, Nebraska, O'Neill, Nebraska, Bassett, Nebraska, Brinkman, Krebs, Oklahoma, Henrietta, Oklahoma. La Crosse, Wisconsin is a big one. Parishes that developed that he was the visiting pastor of. That he was the pastor of. He may have only been there a couple times a year, but he really was the pastor. St. George Kearney. Well, he was here a lot. St. Simon Church in Ironwood. St. George in Cedar Rapids. I don't have Cedar Rapids on that. What am I doing? Oh, well. That would be redundant. St. Elias in La Crosse, Wisconsin. St. Thomas in Sioux City, Iowa. And St. George in Wichita, Kansas. The cathedral, he was the visiting pastor of our cathedral. Okay? They even say in a Lebanese reunion from the time, he was like the leader of the community. So he wasn't just a visiting itinerant preacher or priest in some of the places he went. Finally, priests who were his parishioners. Father Elias Sadie from Beirut became the priest of St. Elias in La Crosse. He came here to be trained by Father Nicola. He was Father Nicola's parishioner in La Crosse, Wisconsin, the whole time Father Nicola was going up there. He formed this man. Father John Saba, a friend from FIA. Again, from Ironwood, Michigan. He's there as a parishioner in Ironwood, Michigan while Father Nicola is going there. He formed this man. Both these would go on later to other parishes as well. These two, we know he was close with them because they came to his funeral. Father Michael Yanni, who's also at his funeral, who's ordained after Father Nicola dies for this parish in 1923, from Thea as well. He becomes the Sunday school teacher after Father Nicola dies. He's his nephew, 10 years younger. He comes here in 1904 to this community because his uncle and his family's here. He formed this man. Father Elias Hemati. There's two Father Elias Hematis during this time. He's ordained as the successor about less than a year after Father Nicola's death. He's from Afsdik. Like a mile and a half, 2 miles down the hill the other way from Thea. Did they know each other back in Syria, back in Lebanon? Well, we don't know, but they were close in their villages. And he and his family lived in Boston for a time, but they came and they were in Poplar Bluff, Missouri, and in that area. And that, what we know, Father Nicola visited there. So Very, very, very likely, Father Elias, well, not very likely, for sure. Father Elias was, for a time, one of these parishioners that Father Nicola visited. And then finally, very likely, Father Joseph Kasseri, who was the pastor in Cedar Rapids. He came from Ein Arab, and very likely, he was in Cedar Rapids for a number of years while Father Nicola was visiting there, and then he becomes ordained in 1916 for that parish. We have communities, he's baptizing, we have churches, and we even have a handful of priests that really have some connection, and some of them a very, very direct and formative connection with Father Nicola. Okay. This is a photo of Father Nicola's funeral. It takes place on November 4th, 1918. Father John Saba, Father Elias, Father John Saba, Father Elias Sadie, Metropolitan Germanos, Father Nicola, is letting his beard grow out again. E.K., Brother George, Nephew Michael, Son Moses, Son John.
That was here.
That was not here. That was in the old church. Look at these. Recognize those guys? They're upstairs. Recognize that? It's upstairs. We still have these things. We still have the gospel that the church gave him. Okay. Spanish flu epidemic in the wake of World War II breaks out at the end of the war. World War I, excuse me. Yes, obviously, yeah. World War I. Different communities force a quarantine, shut down public gatherings. Kearney does not. And finally, in October, the state forces quarantine, which means all public gatherings of any kind are forbidden, which means even no church, no church services. A lot of people were dying. It was very scary. They were doing things like pouring formaldehyde in the streets. They didn't know what to do. During this time, no church. So Father Nicola visits his parishioners who are sick, and he's bringing them communion. And obviously, if they're really sick, he's hearing their confessions. He's bringing them unction. And he becomes sick as well. He still visits them, even though he's sick, even though he's got the Spanish flu, even though he's feeling terrible. And the newspaper reports that even until a few hours before he dies, Father Nicola is being a priest. He dies at home. Pneumonia is what got people. They would have the flu, and then they would contract pneumonia and die from the pneumonia. He dies as his dearly beloved son Elias records in the Annie Family Bible at 11:40 p.m. near midnight on October 28th, actually. The paper reports it as the morning of the 29th. It's actually midnight, near midnight, October 28th, 1918. And his last words to his sons is, "Keep your hands and your heart clean. You know, be pure. Live a pure life." Metropolitan Germanos and, as I said, Father John and Father Elias Sadie come and serve the funeral on November 4th. So there's a week. The community comes, the parish comes, people come from all over. The day after his funeral, his daughter-in-law, who lived with him, took care of him, cooked for him, cleaned for him. Maybe, we don't know, maybe nursed him while he was dying. Gave birth to his first grandchild. The day after he died, a little girl named Martha, after his wife. So we've talked about his life. We come to his death again, and I'd like to read this second obituary that we found. Reverend N.E. Annie Dead passes away at his home in this city Tuesday morning. For the past 20 years, Reverend Annie Yanny has been a most familiar figure on the streets of Kearney. During that time, many noble and worthy deeds can be placed on the proper side of his ledger, but such is to be no more, as death claimed him Tuesday morning, October 29th. Coming to this city 20 years ago, he at once set about in the organization of a Syrian colony and later established a Syrian Orthodox Church. From that time on until his death, he lived and worked for his people and church, doing good wherever he went. None who knew him spoke other than good of him. He held his people in his confidence and never missed an opportunity to speak to them, encourage them, and help them. During the present quarantine for Spanish influenza, several of his people were afflicted, and although not feeling well himself, he called upon them to encourage them in their affliction and giving them what attention he could. This work he continued until death called him Tuesday morning. That his people will miss him, and that his familiar figure will be missed upon our streets, is certain. These words are not from his people. These words are not from his parishioners. These words are from the people who saw him and were around him and knew him in this town. Who didn't know him as a priest, as a pastor, as their priest and their pastor. And yet look at what they are saying about him. This, I believe, is very high praise indeed. And I think this points to the kind of man that he was. That the community would say this kind of thing about him. So, that's it for the presentation. Are there any questions or comments? I know it's been a long presentation. We've gone almost an hour and a half. Any other questions or
what happened to his vestments?
We don't know.
No. So he wasn't buried with them?
Well, he was, but he had more than one set. You can tell in some of the pictures he has a different set of vestments than the one he's wearing in that common picture from 1909. Mm-hmm. One set he's buried in, and the other set the other sets were probably given away. I mean, the priests are poor. He makes $45 a month. He supplements his income by raising crops, and when he's gone, renting out his land. There's a lot more details that we don't have time to give, but he takes out a mortgage on his own property, probably to live or to help family. So they're probably given away to other priests to use. We know the wardrobe that he kept his vestments in, Steve, Rocky's brother, has.
That he kept it in, and he has it. We still have that in the family. Mm-hmm. The vestments disappeared.
Well, yeah, they were given, and that would be done. I mean, you know, you don't need them. Or they would have been left at the church, and the next priest would have used them, and then after they were worn out, they would have been burned or something disposed of reverently.
And we still have his family Bible, or his Bible that he used
They still have the family Bible,
okay.
4 inches thick, which he's recorded a lot of family history in, a lot of, you know, baptisms, births, deaths.
And then we still have the two books, one with the baptisms and the funerals.
The family has the baptismal records, the marriage, and the marriage and the funeral records. I'm just repeating it for these people,
yes,
so they can hear. So,
fine.
All right. Well, thank you all.
Yeah.